Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. Okay, thank you. Thank you. So I hope you've all been outside enjoying the weather. Do you have enough windows open there? Are you getting enough air in? Yeah. So just quietening the mind, relaxing, sharpening the mind. And without prayers, just make a very strong motivation, strong positive motivation for this afternoon. Thank you. So, if you can spend a minute or so just bringing to mind the main points of this morning, just without me telling you, just you don't have to remember everything, but see if you can remember one or two which were to you were quite crucial. Try to bring them to mind now. Here is where making notes is very helpful. If your brain's a bit sun muddled like mine, just ask yourself the question, do I and all phenomena exist? Ask yourself that question, see where it takes you. So hopefully it takes you to, of course I exist, so does all phenomena. But I'm beginning to distrust the way it appears to exist to my mind. It seems that nothing exists in isolation. Nothing exists in isolation. Nothing exists independent of other phenomena that we interact with. Therefore, we are all selfless and interdependent. That's how we finished this morning. If that's the case, emptiness and, well, emptiness of inherent existence and dependent arising are connected. They're closely connected. They are mutually supportive, not mutually exclusive. Broadly speaking, how does this connection work? Well, you could say all phenomena are empty because all phenomena are dependently arising. All phenomena exist dependently. The great Nagarjuna, who really expounded this whole wisdom aspect and whom all schools of Tibetan Buddha revere very highly for his wisdom, said that because there is no phenomena that is not a dependent arising, because there is no phenomena that is not a dependent arising, there is no phenomena that is not empty. And here, it could sound torturous, and I've said to you a couple of times, many of the wisdom aspects are often explained initially in the negative. Okay, it's not this, it's not that. There's a lot of negative words used simply because we're deconstructing what we think we know. So because there is no phenomena that is not a dependent arising, there is no phenomena that is not empty. A very interesting way of looking at that. Often we look at it like this when you're in meditation. You're looking at the emptiness of the object, whatever object you brought to mind. You're looking for the emptiness. You're thinking to yourself, if it exists, it is empty. If it exists, it's empty. Because it exists, it's a dependent arising. Interesting. You come at it from two different angles. You're looking, in some meditations, you're looking for the emptiness of the object. And you could easily say, if it exists, it's empty. But you could also say, because it's empty, it exists. If it weren't empty of inherent existence, would you be able to point to it? So it's another, you know, all these reasonings are interesting. If it exists, it's empty. Interesting. Anyway, so when you're doing this, remember there are many different lines of reasoning. Within the Galupa, we highly value the four-point method that we've been doing this morning. There's also, as I said to you before, there's also a seven-point line of reasoning. Seven-point line of reasoning. Very good. The point of doing this, of course, is to free the mind really from two extremes. The extremes of nihilism and the extremes of eternalism. Both are great errors. There's a couple of teachers many years ago said when he teaches that, he's careful because... Now, this is what he said. It's not what I'm saying. But what he said was, people who are highly intelligent are more likely to fall into the error of nihilism as opposed to eternalism. You know, nihilism, nothing exists. This doesn't exist. What are you talking about? I mean, if you apply these reasoning, you can fall into this line of nihilism. And a couple of times, different teachers had said to me, you know, you have to be careful with the people who are bright. You know, and when I talk about bright, I'm not talking about non-stupid and stupid people. I'm talking about people who are highly intelligent, who have honed their mind in a certain way. They're more likely to fall into the error of nihilism. It was very interesting because I was falling into the error the other way, so that was quite good. So if you want to see how things exist, the depending arising of it, then you have to see the causes and conditions behind that dependent arising. You have to see it's a dependent arising. So that's number one, causes and condition. Number two, you have to see that they exist because of their parts. They exist dependently because of their parts. And they exist in the third way, on the thoughts that label them. Now, I've said that before, but this particular thing needs a lot more investigation. This is not the space for it at the moment. But as long as you know that, that's a very healthy. So you could say, phenomena do not exist from their own side, independent of 1, 2, and 3. Independent of causes and condition, independent of their parts, and independent of the mind that labels them. Phenomena don't exist from their own side. Without 1, 2, and 3, nothing can exist. Nothing can exist without 1, 2, or 3. You wouldn't be able to point to it. Now, because of this, and if you go more deeply into the three types of dependent arising, then really it's a very powerful means to comprehend both sides of reality, conventional reality and ultimate reality. So conventional reality says every single thing exists because it is a dependent arising. But at the same time, everything exists ultimately. There's an ultimate level of truth here, and that's force, that cuts, that destroys the notion of independence, an independent existence. It cuts the notion of inherent existence. So here you start looking at mind, conventional truths and ultimate truths. So if you see books or articles looking at the two truths, this is what they're talking about. This is what they're talking about. And skill is necessary because you want to cut inherent existence, but not cut the actual existence of the object. So understanding the two truths is going, even at a very low level, is going to be important. You don't want Dharma to lead you into nihilism. The great Lama Tsongkhapa, 14th, 15th century sage, monk, and the one who established the Gelugpa tradition that His Holiness the Dalai Lama is in this school represents, he says, really, we need all the lines of reasoning to get here. We need the 7-point analysis. It's important. You'll find that. If you look for it, you'll find it. It's quite a straightforward meditation. You need the 4 possibilities. You need dependent arising in order to approach the profound level that's necessary to see the absence of inherent existence. This absence, what absence is important. The absence of it. As you're working your way through this, you will use the conceptual mind, of course. And you will use concepts, and you need to use them. His Holiness said, you need to use the concepts we have. You're not trying to get rid of them. You're using the concepts to understand ultimate reality. So the first step is really what it's leading to is kind of like an incontrovertible insight to the nature of reality. And once you become familiar with this through study, but mostly through meditation, then when you're in meditation, you start getting glimpses and spaces of seeing the ultimate nature of reality. When you come out of meditation, you go into the world, again, it's just conventional. But over time, it starts bleeding in, this reality starts bleeding into when you're off the cushion. And eventually you see ultimate reality as you live your life, whether you're on the cushion or off the cushion. If you want, you can look up something called yogic direct perception. That's really what they're talking about here. But in the beginning, we really need to understand that the realization of emptiness doesn't happen without these concepts, the conceptual mind that understands emptiness. These things don't happen unless you've got a really good intellectual understanding of emptiness. But because that wisdom, as I said to you this morning, is not bound by conceptual knowledge, but it leads you to a place where you can begin to experience. And once you experience and you get this insight, then you get real understanding. And with that, as I said this morning, that's what you start applying to the three marks of existence: impermanence, dukkha, non-self. Start to see what it is. And the hints should be here, it should be growing, that really, we really need to be able to develop shamatha. Some level of shamatha is absolutely crucial. You can get an intellectual understanding of all of this without shamatha. But direct realization, getting that insight, you need to be able to concentrate, you need to be able to focus. So it's worthy, every Buddhist should be considering developing shamatha, developing it. So Geshe Tashi, when he's talking about this, some of his is so clear. He said, emptiness and dependent arising, they're connected. But where they merge, our world also emerges. Our world arises and functions, and we function within it because of the merging of dependent arising and emptiness. So we're saying, where emptiness and dependent arising merge, our world arises. What world? The conventional world and the ultimate world. The conventional way of seeing things and the ultimate way of seeing things. That's how it functions. If you're holding on to a few things about emptiness, you can say emptiness explores the ultimate nature of reality. That's what emptiness does. It explores the ultimate nature of existence. How? By establishing the absence of inherent existence. That's how it does it. Dependent arising explores the conventional mode of existence by establishing how things exist. In the end, it brings you to the same conclusion, which is the final mode of existence, but it's reached from different directions. So if you look at your table that you're resting your books on, this doesn't mean that that table doesn't exist. The object that we conventionally see as table, that does exist. But the tableness, the self-existent solid tableness of our conceptual mind only exists as a generality. It only exists as a generality because it's a mere construct. I'm going to finish this bit here by saying, I've said to you before, but for self-study or if you come to a teaching where they're going to go into the mind, just the mind, they're not doing just the mind, then there will be a lot of teaching on concepts and perception. So I want to say this about conceptual apprehension. From a Buddha Dharma point of view, conceptual apprehension always apprehends the object via what's called a generic image. A generic image. So So when we think table, there's a generic image appears to mind that's superimposed on whatever you're apprehending. Cup. That there's a concept, an image flashes in the mind, if using conventional, of a generic image of a cup. That's superimposed upon the actual article. So what does this say? It means that conceptually, how we see things is always, there's always something between perception and the object. And what's between is what's called a genetic image. Why do we need to know this? Because if you do know this, you begin to understand that whatever you perceive it indirectly. You perceive it barely. You perceive it unclearly. But the concepts have a job to do. And its job really is to label and impute labels on objects. It has a function. But the function is not to see things clearly. Concepts are reactive. It's a very active way of looking at something. It's very reactive. But it never engages with the real object. Now, when they start talking about perception, then what you're going to work with is a perception. When you perceive an object, there's nothing in between you and the object. There's no generic image. You perceive the object directly by affirmation. You affirm the object, and you affirm it without exaggeration, without any add-ons. Without exaggeration, definitely, you see the object clearly and you see the object exactly, accurately. That perception is very receptive. It's not reflective. It doesn't reflect and think and add bits. It's not a reflective, it's a perceptive. And it never uses generic images. Really, it's seeing the raw data without any add-ons. The conceptual mind we're using all the time, what does it do? Well, apart from what I've said, it adds content. It adds a lot of content. It adds discrimination. It labels, it categorizes. It says if it's good or bad or friend or enemy, if it's beautiful or ugly. This is concepts. Yeah. And we use that to live our lives. It's important. Is it true? On a conventional level, yes. It's how things exist, conventionally. Ultimately, no. So somehow when you're studying this, it's coming to terms with these two truths and seeing them as supportive and not exclusive. Because that's the crux of this way of viewing things. So I don't intend to go into that in any detail but you need to, what I'm saying is if you now see it and you're studying it, you've got an idea what this is all about. And I highly, if you can get teachings on the two truths, I would certainly go for it. Very helpful for the wisdom, very helpful. So I mentioned about the Rice Seedling Sutra. Now, when I mention these books or rice seedlings, don't think because I say it that it has to be, there's something absolutely very, very special there, so I must rush out and get it. I don't say it like that. I personally think all these books on Dharma are very special. I'm literally just sharing things that you can check. You can check it on Google. You can Google Rice Seeding Sutra. It will tell you. You don't have to go buy books. But if you are interested, as Veena was, then the book, It's not a book on the right. It's literally a book on the Four Noble Truths by Geshe Tashi Tsering. And there's quite close to the beginning of that, maybe the first 15% of that book, there comes a section on the Rice Seedling Sutra. It comes from The Foundation of Buddhist Thought, Volume 1. Geshe Tashi Tsering. I used it, I found it extreme. Well, I find all Geshe Tashi's books on Foundation of Buddhist Thought absolutely wonderful. I just love it, love it. So it's not to say to rush out and buy it, but to know that it's there. But you could easily Google this and get commentaries on it very easily. Okay. Any general questions about what we've done so far this afternoon? Yes, Gabriel.
I can't remember whether it was today or another day, but you mentioned you've got the three kind of types of dependent arising, I suppose, causes and conditions, parts.
Oh, yes.
And yes. I think you said that they weren't all necessary, so you can have some things that exist.
Well,
one or two.
When you go into this a bit more, there might be concepts and ideas and types of phenomena that you can't see the cause and condition of. Okay? So, and you can then say, well, I can't see that just now. But are there parts? If there are parts, then definitely this is a dependent arising. And by parts, I mean many things. I don't just mean arms and legs, but if there's a north part of this phenomena, a south part, an east part, a west part, it has parts. And nothing is separate from the mind that labels it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so let's do another meditation. You can never do too many meditations on emptiness. So as long as you're not too hot and you've got enough air coming in, it's difficult to do these things when it's a bit stuffy. So bringing the mind inward. Anything you did up to this point is in the past. It doesn't require your thought. Anything that you're going to do in the future, just a fallacy, right here, right now, that's important. So bring the mind inward. Be aware of how your whole body responds to each in-breath and out-breath. Each in-breath and out-breath. Once you've withdrawn externally into the internal, now begin to relax. You can start at the crown of your head and feel your scalp relaxing. And as your scalp relaxes, it sends ripples of relaxation, which cascade gently down the body and through the body. And wherever these ripples touch, all tension is eased. All muscles are relaxed. maintaining that level of relaxation, shift your focus to the in-breath and allow the mind to naturally brighten on each natural in-breath. And so far today, we've identified the object of negation as this inherently existing I. And we went to look at, to see if this inherently existing I resides anywhere in the body, in the mind, in the body and mind, or separate from the body and mind. Hopefully the conclusion is this type of self is not findable. If you have the logic of that, you can now start to consider other phenomena because they exist in exactly the same way, selflessly. The great Lama Tsongkhapa said it's not necessary to take every object in the world and see the empty nature of it. Simply choose one or two. Apply the logic. And when you see it, you'll see it in all phenomena. Lama Tsongkhapa said that it would be quite useful to choose something at this stage. It's a very strong object of your attachment, of your grasping. So we're going to choose our body, this body. Now remember, it's not the eye we're looking at here. We're examining the body, your body. Normally, when we say my body, it seems to exist from its own side. It seems to be a single entity, not dependent on its parts or on the mind it labels. This independent body, this single entity, this is the body we're going to search for. If this body exists as it appears to exist, it can only exist in one of two ways. This body you're using now, it can only exist in one of two ways. As its parts or separate from its parts. There's no third possibility here. I want you to consider that. If this body that seems to be a single entity, self-existent, if it exists like that, it can only exist in one of two ways. As its parts are separate from its parts. We don't look at cause and condition here because that applies to the parts already. So it exists as its parts or separate from its parts. Look at the object that's to be negated, be clear. It's the self-existent body, this inherently existing body. That's the object of negation. That's what we search for. That is what's not there. If it exists as its parts, and by this time you're allowing your mind to roam your body, identifying all the different parts of the body internally and externally, if it exists as its parts, which part? Some people might say the brain, the heart. Which part? Does it exist as an individual part? So using the same logic as this morning, if it does, then what are all the other parts? Does it exist as the collection of the parts? Remember the object of negation, the self-existent body. Is it there in the collection of the parts? So now begin to examine. Is it a particular part or is it the collection of parts? Does this inherently existing body, is it in the head, the heart, the bones, the blood, different organs? Is it there? Don't just give yourself an answer. Search. If you search well, you will find something. What you find is an absence of that inherently existing body. If you're leaning towards it's the collection of parts, of course. How can a collection of things that are not body be the body? How can a collection of parts that are non-inherently existent body, bringing all that together, how can it suddenly transform into the self-existent body? If you lost an arm, would the body still appear to you? As an inherently existent body. If you lost your legs, imagine. You still have that idea of an inherently existent body separate from anything else. It can't be a collection of these parts. You can lose many parts and still have that idea of self-existence, inherent existent body. So this self-existent entity that we cherish so highly, if it's not the parts, then it must be separate from the parts. So as before, begin to see the body you have now slowly disappearing from the outside in, body parts drifting away. until your whole body is absent. Where is this inherently existent body? The phenomena of body, where is it? At what point did it disappear? If that phenomena, a self-existent, inherently existent body that we cherish, if it's not its parts, or separate from its parts, what's the conclusion? If you do a good investigation, the conclusion should be there is an absence of that inherently existing body. It is the absence that is the emptiness of the body. Does the body exist? Of course it does. Conventionally, as a dependent arising, due to its parts and due to the mind that labels it body. In no other way does it exist. Even if all the parts that disappeared reappear to us, it would still just be a collection of parts. There's no magical transformation into the body, apart from conventional labeling. Try to recall how this idea of my body appears to us when we are praised or insulted or we have strong fear. Try to remember when you have strong fear or someone has insulted you or praised you, how does that my body, the self-existent body, how does it appear to you? Doesn't it appear to be solid and permanent? To be present from its own side. It doesn't appear as something merely labeled, merely designated by mind onto a collection of parts. Yet, this is the reality. The fact that the body cannot be found, this, remember, inherently existent body, cannot be found on investigation, does not imply the body does not exist at all. Of course it exists. It exists as a conventional imputation. It is the conventional nature of the body, of course. Now that's the body that we're so cherishing, but all other phenomena exist in this way by convention. Nothing is inherently existent. all physical phenomena have parts, have physical parts. All non-physical phenomena have various attributes, characteristics, divisions, directions, all distinguished by thought. And this same type of reasoning can determine the emptiness of all phenomena. Thank you. Please relax, move about, get yourself a bit more energy. And when you've done that, settle down again. Thank you. So once again, if you're ready, get yourself into that meditative state. Please identify, choose any object that you are strongly attached to. Any object. It could be a book, an iPhone, a computer, or something more personal, but choose it. Visualize it in front of you, gaze at it mentally. As you gaze at it, doesn't it seem to exist from its own side? Doesn't it appear to be a single entity? Not depending on its parts or its labels. That's what we're going to search for now, the entity that seems to exist from its own side. Not the object, but the object that seems to exist from its own side, the object that seems to be a single entity depending on nothing. Gaze at the object. If this object exists as it appears, it can only exist in one of two ways: as its parts or separate from its parts. For these meditations, you need to check out. There is no real third possibility. But you may come to a different idea. If you do, keep it in mind. If this single entity, existing from its own side, does exist, it can only exist as its parts or separate from its parts. If it exists as its parts, individually or collectively, if a part, which part? Now at this stage, you let your mind explore that object. Imagine its interior, its exterior. If it exists as a part, which part? If you decide on one part, then what are the other parts? They're non-object. if it's not a single part, then look to see, is it a collection of its parts? Always remembering what you're looking for, the object of negation, the self-existent object. If it doesn't exist as a single part, does it exist as a collection of those parts? The collection of the parts is something, but it's not an inherently existent thing. The collection of parts can't be the object. Each part is a non-object. You've come to that conclusion, hopefully. This inherent existing object is not a part. And when you look at it as a collection of parts, how can it be a collection of non-objects? How can a collection of non-objects be the object? So maybe it exists separate from that object. So once more, imagine that object slowly dispersing, disappearing from the outside in until it's completely disappeared. Where is the solid, unchanging object now? Where is it? Is it there? Anywhere? So it's not its part.